I never wanted to lay around with a girl. I could lay around with you all day. It's gonna sound corny, Harry, but laying around with you, I feel like I'm home. I'll feel the same way. It's comforting to have no clothes on with you, lie around, hold you. I think it takes a lot of guts to be open about yourself. I feel like I'm getting closer to being ready for it. What have I been doing? It was always whenever anyone would talk about gay people in front of me, I would clench up inside and wait for the subject to change. Man, I wish there was a better word than gay. I don't like the word gay. Yeah, it's not very sexy. I don't like it either. Anyway, why do you have to give everything a label? You are what you are with the girls, and you are what you are with me. I am what I am with the girls, and I am what I am with you. What are you like there? What are you thinking? No, I was just thinking about you. I think you're much more artistic than you know, and that you should produce a movie which would allow all your latent artistic gifts to see the light of day. That's what I'm thinking. I should produce a movie with you, Harry. We should produce a movie together. He sits bolt upright on the bed. Harry, we should make a movie. And I'm thinking, bingo. Mark gets on it. Calls around all the writers' agencies, asks them to send scripts for a low-budget movie he would be producing, and all these screenplays start showing up at the door. All of them are bloody awful. This is a bunch of codswallop. You should write your own. So he starts to try to write a film script about his childhood relationship with his reclusive grandfather who survived the Nazis. It was a beautiful story. And the funny thing was, Mark could write. Mark comments on the script as it was coming along, if I do say so myself, were rather on the mark. And I think that's what I am. Harry Clark is a man who makes movies. It's all systems go there for a bit. Whole thing goes awry when Mark starts researching writers he admired, finds they have one thing in common. They were all drunk when they wrote their best work, which gives him license to start drinking from the moment he gets out of bed. And between this and the speed he's taking so he can work into the night and the ubiquitous cocaine, sometimes I feel like I'm the ringmaster of a three-ring circus. I want you to lay off the drugs, is what I'll say to him in the living room. I don't think we're ever going to get the movie made unless you do. It's making you crazy. And what am I going to do if you accidentally OD? Don't you ever tell me that I shouldn't drink or do drugs or smoke a joint or do a line of coke ever. You understand me? I like cocaine. If I want to do cocaine, I'm going to do cocaine. Do you understand? Don't want to ever hear that shit again. You are in my world now. You understand? You get it? And that is the moment I'll see a side of Mark I haven't seen up to this point. I go up on the roof, think, that's a spoiled rich brat who's turning into a junkie. I've got to get out of this. Then, I think, whoa, whoa, whoa. Eyes on the road, Harry. Eyes on the road. After Mark sleeps it off, he's all apologies, but I can feel the reality of the film ever happening slipping away quickly. One night, Mark's erratic behaviour is driving me up the bloody wall. Take myself to the movies. I'm coming out of the cinema when I get an unexpected phone call. Harry? Hey, it's Stephanie Schmidt. Oh, hello. I'll come straight to the point, Harry. Is that offer of temptation still good? Yeah, it is. When do you want to be tempted? How about right now? Where are you? In the apartment we jump in where we'd left off. You are a sexy fucking girl.
Harry, you don't know how much I needed to hear that. I'm living with a guy I love who is perpetually depressed, and right now if I touch him, he flinches like I've given him an electric shock.
You want to do some things you've never done before?
You remembered.
I'm hardly a wide back boy, but I'll give it a go. Lead her to the bed, pull up her dress. Stephanie Schmidt is not the kind of girl who buys her underwear at the Gap.
Nice knickers, I'll say, and I'll pull them down, throw them on the floor. That is the most immaculate-looking Brazilian wax I've ever seen. She giggles.
It was a Hanukkah present from my girlfriends at work.
Thank you, girlfriends at work. Thank you very, very, very much. 2 hours later, I'll put her in a cab back to her life, and I'll get in another cab and go down to Lafayette. Mark is asleep when I walk in. I'll breathe in his ear. Wake up. Wake up. You smell like the perfume my sister always wears. My friend, I went to the movie with wears a lot of perfume. I want to make love to you. I'm asleep. I can't stop thinking about you. You're like an obsession. The way you taste. The way you look. Watching you sleep just now, I'm so full of feeling. I think I'm gonna burst. You know what one of my favorite things to do is? Pulling down your knickers and chucking them across the room, just like this. Come on. Come on. Come on. But the cocaine binges are really getting under my skin. They're making him incredibly paranoid. Start keeping a journal, which I know he's reading, so I begin catering to my audience. Writing about the minutiae of our relationship, telling him things he wants to hear. Then it comes to me. I'm going to have a will drawn up and leave everything to Mark. The flat in London that I've told him I have, the contents of the studio uptown, whatever there is of mine in his apartment, the whole kit and caboodle. Find a lawyer to draw up a draft that I have no intention of signing, and leave the draft in an envelope sticking out the side of my bag. I come in one day, Mark's all emotional.
I gotta confess, I went through your bag. I opened up that envelope. I read your will, and I'm so moved.
I don't have much, but of course, I'm going to leave everything to you. And then comes the night where he decides that he should get so drunk that he'll make himself so ill that he'll never want to touch a drink again. The evening climaxes with him screaming at me and stumbling into a standard lamp which goes smashing into my face, cut my bloody nose, and I'll say, I'm leaving! And I'll walk out on him. And every strung-out sounding phone message he leaves for me goes unreturned.
I cut the blonde out of my hair, flush it down the toilet, and that Harry Clark period of my life draws to a close. Things go back to the way that they were. I'm back to treading the pavements, trying to get a job. 5 months go by, I think. I can't afford to stay in New York anymore. Can't get work. Don't know what I'm going to do or where I'm going to go. I come home and there's a message on my answering machine.
Mr. Clark, my name is Brad Gould. I'm the lawyer representing the estate of the late Mark Schmidt. Can you please call me at your earliest convenience? My number at the office is...
I'm thinking... The late Mark Schmidt? So I call this Brad Gould.
I assumed you knew, Mr. Clark. I'm sorry to have to be the bearer of this news. Mr. Schmidt was on his way to a rehab facility in North Carolina when he suffered a heart attack. He died about 2 months ago, and you are the sole beneficiary of the will. But, Mr. Clark, I think I should also tell you, the family's attorney has advised them to contest the validity of the will. As Mr. Schmidt had a well-documented drug history, they feel he didn't have his full faculties when the will was drawn. And there is an additional factor that all the money from the recent sale of the family's boat, the Jewish American Princess, had not yet been distributed. A third each to Stephanie and her mother, but remained in Mark's accounts.
Can I call you back? I'm in a state of shock hearing about Mark's death.
I hang up, and I think, will you cry? Just cry. But I call back.
How much is the estate worth?
With all the assets combined, including the revenue from the sale of the boat and the estimated value of the Lafayette Street apartment, the estate is valued somewhere in the region of $11 to $12 million.
I hang up and fly into panic mode. I cannot take this money. It's blood money. And besides, there is no such person as Harry Clark.
But there could be. Look, you got no money. You can't get work. You're going to move back to South Bend, Indiana, Philip Brugelstein? What are you going to do? Get a job waiting tables in Olive Garden? Red Lobster filling up the shelves in Walmart? You do need me. You should legally change your name to Harry Clark. This will stuff is going to take a while to sort out. Meantime, you'll get your name changed. Let me go back to the lawyer that drew up the Harry Clark will. I'll tell him that I am the sole inheritor of a substantial amount of money from my friend who may not have been in his right mind when he made up his will, and for the sake of fairness, I want to rewrite the will as a gesture of goodwill and one that has the potential of heading off any aggressive legal action on the part of the Schmidt family.
And this is what we do. Ryan, my lawyer, proposes to liquidate the estate and do a three-way even split. Ruth and Stephanie agree to it. We all come in and sign. Ruth's wearing big dark glasses. On the street outside the estate lawyer's office, Stephanie comes up to me.
Why did my brother leave everything he had to you?
I don't know.
Were you fucking my brother?
I don't say anything. She slaps me across the face.
I thought people only did that in movies.
She walks away. Lawyer Ryan asks me what I'm going to do now that the inheritance has been settled.
I'm going to go to England. I've never been.
He laughs.
I'm going to an exotic island and just sit on the beach.
I fell in love with the Seychelles Islands the moment I stepped off the plane. Feel it in my gut, this is where I'm supposed to be. The first night in the villa, I open up the passport, stare at the photo and the words, Harry Edward Clark. I put the Edward in because I always liked the name. Besides, Philip Brugelstein was such a mouthful. You were always having to spell it. And I mean, really, it's your life. Least you should be able to do is choose your own name. I go into the bathroom and stare at my reflection.
All right. I give up. You got me. Who are you? You look a bit like your father, but you're not your father. You look a bit like your mother, but you're not your mother. Who are you?
Laying out on a deck chair, looking at the Indian Ocean, you can just feel yourself coming back to yourself. All the disparate pieces of your personality settling back into one. This sweet girl from the villa comes over and says, Mr. Clark, can I bring you another drink? No, thank you. And please, call me Harry. But can you put my music on again? Just press play. I did end up going to England, London. I didn't really like it. Didn't like that everyone kind of sounded like me.
And it rained the whole bloody time.
Hello, this is David Cale, playwright of Harry Clark and Lillian, and performing Lillian for you in this Audible theatre piece. Thanks for listening. It's a mystery where characters come from sometimes. Lillian, for me, is one such mystery. I've mostly written one-person shows. My first 5 solos had been collections of stories or collections of monologues where I played different characters. I'd not thought of trying to write an entire show from a single person's perspective till Lillian appeared. While I was performing my 5th show, Somebody Else's House, in San Diego at a performance space called Sushi Inc. in 1993, I began writing what would be the second part of Lillian in the offices of the venue. On the last night of the run, I thought, I wonder if I can slip Lillian into the show. Then figured, it is my show. If I let the person running the lights know, I guess I can do what I want. And on the last night of the run, Lillian went into the show. That 10-minute excerpt subsequently became officially part of Somebody Else's House. When the show later opened in Chicago, it was at that point that I had the notion of wrapping a whole evening around Lillian. At first, this idea was met with the well-meaning words, it's unproducible. A man playing a woman that isn't drag. Lillian isn't campy. Lillian is too low-key. You're never going to get it produced. But I had my heart and mind set on doing it. Out of the blue, I received a phone call from American Repertory Theatre in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They'd lost a booking that was going to be on the main stage and wondered if I had a solo show that could replace it. It was sort of perfect timing. So I went up to Cambridge, and from that point, Lillian was in motion. But where Lillian came from, I don't know. I'm friends with someone reminiscent of her love interest, Jimmy. I have a similar relationship to Brighton that Lillian has. But apart from that, Lillian has a life of her own. It was as if she just showed up. Harry Clark is the only other show I've written that's told from a single character's perspective. In this case, Philip Brugelstein and his alter ego, Harry. As with Lillian, there are few things Philip and I have in common, except a love of movies, and like Philip as a kid felt he could be himself if he had an English accent, I as a little kid growing up in England did feel I could truly be myself if I had an American accent. But Philip too just appeared. And in a way, like Lillian, determined his own story. I write aloud, and with both Lillian and Philip, I was almost a secretary, writing down what they said as their stories came out of my mouth via my imagination. Lillian and Philip seemed unrelated characters to me at first, and also unrelated to my other shows, till I looked a little closer. Many of the stories I write are about a romantic or sexual relationship having some kind of transformative effect on the lives of both parties. And I realize Lillian and Jimmy have that effect on one another, as do Philip, a.k.a. Harry, and Mark Schmidt. Lillian and Philip are very different people. Lillian is honest in the world, Philip is not. But both their lives are dramatically changed by a chance encounter. And both of them operate on instinct, more than what their brain is telling them. They're instinctive, intuitive people, which connects them to me. All my writing is instinctive and intuitive. And as I'm not trained as an actor, if I'm performing the show myself, all my performance is instinctive and intuitive as well. Maybe the expression chance encounter is the key. Both Lillian and Philip's lives are changed by a chance encounter. And in some ways, the course of my life was changed by a chance encounter with them. Philip Brugelstein and Lillian Foyle.
And now, Lillian. Written and performed by David Cale.
Chrysanthemums are considered to be late bloomers. Originating in China, They date back as far as 500 years BC. The wild native version of the species has now almost disappeared, having been completely overshadowed by its more colourful domesticated relative. For optimum results, chrysanthemums require a clay soil, a sunny yet cool location, ideally facing south, and loam. They're what's known as short day plants, meaning they are light sensitive and produce buds only as the days grow shorter and the nights grow longer. To improve the quality of the flowers, the first bud that appears should be pinched. That's according to most chrysanthemum experts, in whose ranks I now number myself, thereby increasing the radiance of the subsequent flowers. The other day, I overheard a landscape gardener talking to a woman I know who designs plaster gnomes to put on your front lawn, a garden ornament whose appeal has frankly always eluded me. Anyway, the landscape gardener says, I realized recently that I have been mildly depressed for the last 15 years. The gnome lady asks, how come you only realize that now? He answers, because I don't feel that way anymore. It's funny what you just happened to overhear. I wonder if it's true that all the secrets of our lives are whispered into our ears at birth, that the secrets then attach themselves to our unconscious. As years pass, occasionally a secret will break free and make its way up into our daily thoughts. They are then referred to as premonitions. I think we know everything that's going to happen to us. People come into your life for a reason. There are no accidents. There's nothing haphazard about it or coincidental. What may seem random at the time, I think in the end has a kind of correctness. I mean, in retrospect, when you look back on your life, if you're able to be honest with yourself, I think you come to realize it could not have happened any other way. The thought of someone else inside you is something I could never come to terms with, Keith had said to me before he went up north on that job. I could get over somebody kissing you or cuddling, but if someone else went inside, I don't think I could ever touch you again. Don't be dramatic, I'd said. Nobody's going anywhere with me. Then almost the minute the door shut, Keith was hardly in his precious Volvo when I meet little Jimmy in the store, 15 years my junior, with a look on his face that could drag a shipwreck up from the bottom of the ocean. Wipe that dirty look off your face, Jimmy Foyle, I said, and stop trying to put your fingers in my mouth. I'm a married woman. Oh, God, I couldn't believe the words were coming out of me. It was like my husband just flew out the window. A Jimmy was really what I'd had in mind for a lover before I met Keith. He was the kind of person I always wanted when I was his age, but who never seemed interested in me. I wasn't generally a Jimmy's type. Jimmy's didn't generally take notice of women like me. We seemed, I don't know, too tame. Jimmy was a wild one. Rough around the edges, he was a bit of a devil. Didn't give things a lot of thought the way Keith did. And he was funny. Keith had nothing approaching a sense of humour. Actually, Keith was the only person I knew that didn't find me funny in any way. I can't believe that, Jimmy said. You're a riot. How refreshing, I thought, to be found funny again. It was really the idea of a Jimmy coming along that kept me from completely giving over to Keith. I'd been holding out for the thought of a Jimmy for a long time. So when he aimed his eyes at me and came on so strong that day, something in me was saying it would not be a good idea to turn Jimmy down. It'll be a little fling. You have to work out this Jimmy thing. Lillian, it's between you and yourself. Jimmy knew Keith was out of town. I think he'd even been watching the precious Volvo to see if it was still in the front. He invited me over to his house to see his lizards. Lizards, I said. Yes, lizards, he said. How peculiar, I said. All right, Jimmy. He drove his car like he'd just robbed a bank. We ran a red light. Hold on to your seat, Lillian, I thought. His car didn't have safety belts. I cut them off, he said. They were uncomfortable. I thought about Keith, Keith wouldn't start the engine unless everyone was strapped in. Jimmy's house was lined with tiny aquariums. He got all excited as he told me what the various lizards were and where they came from. He was quite the authority. Outside of the store, he looked much younger. God, Lillian, I thought, what are you doing? When he made his move on me, it was so sudden. Talk about a pounce. Even the lizards scuttled behind their plastic rocks. I immediately felt like I'd been thrown into a wrestling ring. As we were rolling around on his leopard blanket, I must confess my first thought was, am I really enjoying this? He was so rough and young. There was no warming up with Jimmy. In fact, much to my surprise, it was dreadful. It's funny, I realized I'd gotten used to Keith's mouth. Jimmy had a smaller mouth. I think Keith's tongue was wider too. There was nothing sensual about Jimmy's tongue. It just sort of flickered around in my mouth, like the tongues of one of those lizards of his. Whatever was wrong with Keith, the sexual part was all right. Or maybe I'd overrated it a bit, but he was considerate. Sexually speaking, I'd say Keith was like a really good waiter in a pretty good restaurant. Very good service, but ultimately disappointing food. Jimmy seemed to approach the whole thing like it was some form of kung fu, or that I was something that needed to be overthrown, but really I was just laying there. He was nervous, bless him. I tried to get him to ease up. Slow down, I said, in a voice that was supposed to sound seductive, but I have to admit it did come out rather motherly. If I slow down, he said, I'll lose the erection. God, I thought, this is dreadful, as he's pulling my sweater over my chin. Then he breathed into my ear. Can I fuck you, Lillian? And I thought about Keith, and what the thought of someone else being inside me would do to him, and how it really would be the final straw. And I said, yes, Jimmy, if you want. He got all excited, ran into another room, came back with a rubber Johnny, and he had trouble opening the packet, bless him. And I'm thinking, if I let Jimmy inside, there's no going back. He lays back down on top, and I put my hand on the erection that he was so afraid of losing, which I realized I hadn't even looked at yet. So I took a peek. Oh dear, I thought, men's penises are all starting to look the same, as I helped it find its way inside. Is it in? Jimmy asked. He was nervous, bless him. Yes, I said. It's in. Jimmy takes this as his cue to start pounding away at me with his eyes scrunched shut. Christ, look at me, I thought. I hate it when men shut their eyes and lock off in their own world. You're in my world now, felt like saying. And I'm thinking of Keith on that oil rig. Wish Keith got more excited about doing things. We should have gone on holidays, little adventures. It was such a routine. Wish Keith would get all riled up. Wish he'd get passionate about something. Oh, I don't know, about life or me. Or lose his temper. You know I love you, he'd say. I don't need to keep telling you. I wouldn't dream of looking at another woman. And he wouldn't. And I'm looking at Jimmy's lizards. Can they really be happy in those little tanks, with a light bulb over their heads morning and night? And I look at Jimmy on top of me, and his face looks like it's in such pain. His eyes are still squeezed shut. There's sweat forming on his forehead. And he took so long. God, I wish he'd have his orgasm and this could be over. It's starting to feel a little like a visit to the dentist's more than a sexual fling. Then Jimmy makes a noise like he's been shot in the leg, and I realize, thank God, he's having his little eruption, bless him. He rolls over to the other side of the blanket. Oh, that was sexy, he said. Yes, I said, it was very, thank you. Oh, Lillian, polite to the end. But then Jimmy did some really sweet things. He ran a bath, put something blue in the water. He showed me his muscles. Ooh, I said. He lit candles. He was quite romantic after all. He was a boy, really. I half expected the police to come barging in and arrest me. Did I disappoint you? He said. No, of course not, I said. For a moment he looked so vulnerable, that I thought my heart would break. We sat in the bath. He was behind me. He did my back, drew objects on my shoulders in soap and had me guess what they were. "It's a giraffe," I said. "No, it's a crane," he said. "You win," I said. He was laughing. He looked even younger with his hair wet. He has lovely olive eyes. I didn't realize we were in the water lit by the birthday candles, bless him. One day some young woman's really going to lose her bearings just looking into those eyes, I thought. And I got a little rush of sadness, but not anything so big that it would register on my face. He dried me with a fresh towel. He fixed a snack. We watched the telly. He had his hand on my thigh. He asked, "How does your pussy feel?" I said, "What did you say?" He said, "You heard me." I said, "That's for me to know and you to imagine, cheeky bugger." I smiled. He laughed. "Oh, Lillian, you're right," he said for the second time. I mean, what could I say? Actually, I'm in distinct discomfort. Would have broken his heart, bless him. And he was playing with the nape of my neck with his fingers, and it was tickling me in a sort of irritating way, but I didn't say anything. And one of Jimmy's lizards is watching us with a large cricket in its mouth, which it's in the process of crunching on. The cricket's antennae are waving slowly as its body disappears. And I'm thinking of Keith in his Volvo, following the taillights of another car with his radio on. He was probably near Scotland by then, with that perpetually anxious look on his face that he inherited from his father. And Jimmy's giggling at a commercial on the television, looking all of 16. And they're both nice men, sweet men, you know, good people. And as the damn television is chattering away in the background, all I can think is, well, my dear, now what? When I was young, my school reports all said the same thing. She has potential, but she has a tendency to procrastinate. I didn't know what the word meant. Neither did my mother. She was always saying, "Yeah, I must buy a dictionary tomorrow and look up that word." That little memory has always nagged at me for some reason. That and memories of Brighton. I've always felt a special bond with Brighton. I used to go there as a child. My grandfather had a place in Hove, to be more precise. Hove is literally next door. They're right side by side, but some people get quite upset if you confuse them. "The working people go to Brighton," my grandfather used to say, as if he didn't work. "This family is on its way to Hove." It's so silly, really. On the train down, I found myself becoming quite reflective. Keith used to say I spent too much time with my head in the past, and he's probably right. "Don't dwell," he'd say. "The past is gone." And he'd bark out the word "gone." Riding trains always makes me reflective. I'm sure it's all those sights passing you by at such speed that does it. My ex-husband hadn't crossed my mind in a long time, but for some reason I found myself thinking about him on the train to Brighton. You know, one thing that's always stayed with me about Keith was the way he'd say, "I know that one day you'll leave." I'd tell him not to think like that, but I knew he was right. Deep down, the moment I met Keith, I imagined myself saying goodbye to him. I'd been working in a bookstore in London for 6 months, which I did quite enjoy. It was a comfortable position, civilized kind of customer. There were many days when it didn't seem like work. I've always liked being around books. It's funny, I rarely read them. I just like being in their presence, as if at any point you could pick one up, open it, and enhance yourself. I don't know why I won't read. It's as if part of me has always shied away from the idea of any kind of enhancement. It's made all the more peculiar by the fact that I buy books all the time. My house is lined with unread books. Anyway, I decided to take a week off work. It was drizzling in London, February, the store was quiet. Brighton will be empty this time of year, I thought. Time to take some time to recharge. As soon as I get out of the train station there, I always feel a sense of both relief and release.
Oh, the times I've gotten on a train and run back to Brighton. I'd been there for about a day and a half, and it was really doing the trick. There were very few people on the streets. Felt like I had the place to myself. Well, I was walking along the front, past the chalets on the beach, when I hear somebody calling my name. I turn around and see this young man with a beard waving at me. Who on earth are you? I thought, and presumed it must be a customer from the shop. It's me, said the man with the beard. It's Jimmy. Don't you remember? Jimmy, I said, totally taken aback. You look completely different. I would have walked right past you. Besides the beard, he was much slimmer. It's probably my imagination, but I think he'd grown. What are you doing here? I asked. I live here, he said. Since when? Since about 4 years ago. I couldn't get over how different he looked. I don't lift weights anymore, he said. I do Tai Chi. Lost a lot of bulk. Don't have the muscles anymore. And I've gone vegetarian. And you have the beard now, I chimed in. Yeah, my wife says it gives me authority. Your wife, I said. Can you believe it, he said. I got hitched. The whole episode was quite disorienting. Having Jimmy pop up in the middle of my Brighton after how many years? What, 5 was it? He asked me if I'd like to grab a bite. I said I would. I have to say, it was immediately comfortable between us. One thing about Jimmy and I, we always got along. I don't drink coffee anymore, he said, only herb tea. I'm watching my health, but I could have a chamomile tea and a tofu sandwich. I'm very strict. Tofu sandwich, I said. Oh, dear. I should be having a glass of wine, a pastry, a cappuccino, and a cigarette. In that order. Health kick. He laughed. Oh, good, I thought. I'm still amusing to him. While he wasn't looking, I glanced at the side of his face. It'd become quite beautiful. Delicate, almost. In the looks department, I have to say, the little bugger had really come into his own. We went to an awful health restaurant, where they had a lot of attitude and no pastry. And when I tried to light a cigarette, I got a lecture on secondhand smoke. He wanted me to meet his wife. Thought the two of us would get along. Why? I couldn't help wondering. She reminds me of you, he said. She's a bit older than me. Very successful in business, has her own company. I work for her. She trains executives how to speak in public and how to alter their image so they'll become a more effective tool in the marketplace. The whole enterprise sounded positively creepy. I asked him what his role in all this was, and he said he videotaped the executive speaking and that Donna, the wife, would identify their weaknesses and therefore help to rectify them. How old are you now? I asked, somewhat shifting the subject. 26, he said. How old are you? I'm not telling you how old I am, I said. Let's put it this way. When I write down my date of birth now, I put the word circa next to it. Then he asked if I thought he seemed more mature. Apparently Donna was working on having him project a more mature version of himself. Have you noticed I'm speaking slower? He said. Donna got me to do that. She made me watch a video of myself. I had no idea I talked so quickly. I'd never noticed it. Poor Jimmy was starting to sound a bit like someone who's had a complete nervous breakdown and who's slowly pacing themselves back together. And I was gaining the impression he'd married Eva Braun. She's not pointing any cameras at me, I thought. Just as some horrendous-looking alfalfa something or other arrived, he asked me how what's-his-name was. If you mean Keith, I said, I've no idea. I haven't seen Keith for nearly 2 years. Last time I tried to talk to Keith, he said he still wasn't ready to speak to me yet. Was it because of me? He asked, with a tone of slight self-satisfaction. And I have to say, it did irritate me for a moment. I mean, there was a reason Keith and I stayed together for 6 years. It wasn't a complete waste of time. Let's just say you didn't help. One thing about Keith, he could read me like a book. He knew immediately what had happened with Jimmy. The way you talked about him in the store, it was obvious, he'd say.
It's sad, he'd go on. You're like a little girl. You'll fall for anyone who flatters you. Keith always referred to the thing with Jimmy as the episode. You haven't been the same since the episode, was how he'd put it. I really didn't want to meet Donna. I imagined her exuding sex appeal and confidence, and I really wasn't feeling up to comparisons. But I went along with it. For some reason, Jimmy was so eager for us to meet. He called her up, warned her we were on our way, while I excused myself to go to the bathroom for an emergency one-on-one between myself and my face in the bathroom mirror. Oh, God, I hope it's the light in here. Either that, my dear, or it's time to lay off the lattes. Donna was on a business call when we walked in, with her back to us. She was nothing at all like I'd anticipated. Donna was a big girl. I mean, literally. She must have been at least 6'2". And I have to say, and this will sound awfully ungenerous on my part, and it is, but the first thing that drew my attention were her hips. She's probably given birth to something, I presumed. When she turned around, I thought, oh, I'm much better looking than you. And I was sort of surprised at myself how juvenile I was behaving. But I have to say, I did suddenly feel in the mood to be a little, oh, I don't know. Yes, I do. Threatening. Finally, she gets off the phone, waltzes over, extending her hand. I'm sorry, she says. The Americans just think I've got all the time in the world, but they're where the money is, so can't be complaining too much now, can we? Then she kissed Jimmy on the mouth in front of me, which seemed a bit unnecessary, and said, hello, James. James, I thought. James. Jimmy may have been many things. One thing he wasn't was a James. Redirecting her attention towards me. What line are you in, Lillian? She asks. Books, I say, though I seldom read them. Oh, publishing, she says. No, says I, second-hand mostly. Oh, she says. What a pretty shirt you're wearing. And I thought, you cow. I was only there for about 10 minutes, which was quite long enough. Donna said she had a meeting to go to. Oh, AA, I inquired. Oh, you're hilarious, she says. So are you, I replied, which got no response. She said she was going to Germany for the rest of the week for a conference, and that James had the car. Every time she mentioned James, I had to think for a moment who she was talking about. You two can get reacquainted, she said. You don't need me around now, do you? And for a second it felt like she was throwing them at me. Jimmy wanted to give me a tour of the South Coast. So the following day, after Donna left, he picked me up at the hotel and we went driving in her BMW. What happened to your car? I asked. Donna made me get rid of it, he said. I like that car, I protested. It suited you. She approves of you, he said. She thought you were down to earth. Which from a pretentious person is not a compliment. She thinks you're the kind of woman she can imagine me being with much more than her. What does she mean by that? I asked. I don't know, he said. Sometimes I think she's tired of being married to people. I'm her fourth husband. Oh, I said. And then we just drove for a bit without saying anything. The countryside along the South Coast is lovely. And I remembered how much I liked to be in the passenger seat of a car. While Jimmy was driving, I happened to notice his hands on the steering wheel. They looked older. I looked at mine. I'm sure they did too. He slipped in a cassette tape. I lowered my window. A gust of wind blew through the car. My hair went everywhere. Care and all its relatives seemed to fall out of me. Well, I don't know if it was the sea air, the music, too many cappuccinos, or Jimmy. But I felt a sudden wave of enthusiasm. He must have thought my mind had just fluttered out the car window. Right now, I exclaimed, I feel like I'm riding the world. Driving along the coast, we came to a huge funfair. Jimmy wanted to get off the road and investigate. I didn't take much convincing. As we were going in, he stopped in his tracks. I always get excited around you, he said. I feel the same way, I told him. And I realized what it was. You see, you could be romantic with Jimmy and not feel like a fool. I'd been waiting a long time to be romantic with someone. Jimmy was immediately drawn to an enormous roller coaster called the Big Plunge. The Big Plunge was a ride that would go up extremely high, then plummet. Now, I have a terrible fear of heights. There's no way you're going to get me up on that thing, I said. You go if you want to. I'll stay here and have a cigarette. Oh, Lillian, you're afraid of everything, he said. How dare you, I said. I'm not. Come on, he said. Fear at a certain point just becomes another bad habit, which had to have been something he picked up from Donna. The only way I could go on the Big Plunge was by going through a complicated psychological snow job in which I rationalized that my fear of heights actually represented my terror of life and that going on the Big Plunge was extremely important for me and could lead to a personal breakthrough. Besides, if 10-year-old children could do it, so could I. Jimmy managed to grab the front seat. I'm sure I'm the oldest person to ever take the plunge, I said, ever the terrified wit, as the ride yanked everyone forward and the squealing began. First up, I was petrified. Then I seemed to push through the fear. And I have to say, the whole thing did seem like a personal breakthrough. Donna would have been proud of me. Jimmy held my hand for the duration, which was sweet of him. I've never been able to go up on those rides before, but I ended up loving it. Went on 3 more times. It had become completely easy between us. And midway through the day, a strange notion crossed my mind. I can imagine myself being with you for a long time, I thought. By late afternoon, I realized I really was getting a little light-headed around Jimmy. I stood at a distance as he was buying tickets for the next ride, tried to give myself a little talking to. He's 26. He's married. He lives in Brighton, I said to myself. Lillian, stop it. Then out of the blue on the Ferris wheel, he gave me a peck on the cheek. What are you doing? I asked, trying to not sound delighted and failing abysmally. I wanted to kiss you, he said. James, I scolded. Behave. The Ferris wheel then abruptly jolted to a halt, fortunately with us on the low end. While we were waiting to move, Jimmy asked what seemed like an out-of-the-blue question. If somebody told you your life would end in, say, a year, do you think you'd start to really live? Or do you think you'd slip back under the covers and wait for it to be over? I think I'd get a move on, I replied. Just then the wheel began to turn. As we were passing the arcade, I noticed a photo booth. I don't have any pictures of you, I said. Come on, I need some proof that you exist. We were clowning around in front of the camera. Pictures took forever to come out. When they finally did emerge from the machine, I wasn't quite prepared for what I saw. What took me back about the photos was that we looked like two people who were completely in love with each other. I'm sure Jimmy picked up on it too, but neither of us said anything. Driving back to my hotel, I started to feel uneasy. I asked him if he wanted to come up to the room for a bit, dangling the fact that there was a good-sized colour TV. I'd forgotten how small the room was, and it did feel a little awkward. There was nowhere to sit except the bed. We have quite a history, I said. Yes, he agreed. You and me. Placing his hand on my ankle. Your leg feels swollen, he said. I told him it was the circulation, that my varicose veins were getting worse, then regretted drawing attention to them and tried to make a joke. I'm not supposed to ever cross my legs again. Can't they take them out? He asked. The doctor said it would be for purely cosmetic reasons to remove them, and he strongly advised against it. Oh, he said, and then went quiet and seemed withdrawn. What about wearing a special stocking? Please stop talking about varicose veins. They don't exactly make me feel like an attractive proposition. Are you all right? I asked. He didn't say anything. He just nodded. Then I don't know what triggered it exactly, but he just started sobbing.
I fucked up my life, he said.
What's wrong? I asked him.
I wanted to be married to someone. I wanted to make it work. Wanted a family. Didn't want to be like my old man. I hate my life. I want to be a gardener. I want to have a nursery and grow things. I don't want to be videotaping businessmen all day. I hate that world. I want to be outside. Donna says she's not willing to be married to a gardener. She wants to have an open relationship, wants to be able to see other people. I know she's seeing someone in Germany. She doesn't love me. She just likes showing me off to her girlfriends, because I'm young. They call me the puppy. You should hear them. Did you toilet train the puppy yet? Oh, Donna, the puppy is so cute.
Come on, I said. Stop crying. You've got me going now. And I started up. Look at the two of us. We're downright unstable.
Oh, Lillian,
he cried. Come here, I said. Put my arms around him. He felt like a different person without the muscles. With that damn beard. He felt like a stranger. My Jimmy, I said. And I don't know what possessed me, but I really wanted to kiss him. Even though he was distraught and fragile-seeming, and it was probably most inappropriate, I wanted to push through that to his mouth. So I did, and he didn't pull away. And for a second, I thought about Donna, and that I didn't want to go where her lips had been. But then I dismissed that, and I kissed him again. And it was a long kiss. The kind of kiss you could never get bored of. The kind of kiss you could rediscover yourself inside. And it was so tender and unguarded between us. And I knew I was falling, and I did nothing to catch myself. It felt like a dam was opening in my chest, and all these feelings that I'd been waiting for years to put into motion were flooding my entire insides. And I could have had the good sense to get up or ask him to leave, and the dam would have surely blocked, but instead I just let it all come crashing down. On the train back from Brighton the following day, I stared out the window for almost the entire ride. Couldn't tell you if the train was crowded, or if there was even anyone sitting next to me. I took out the strip of photos we'd taken in the booth, examined them. As we came into London, the conductor approached and said to me, "Don't leave anything behind." I said, "What did you say?" Even though I heard him the first time. He said, "Don't leave anything behind." I put the photos in my bag. I looked at him. He smiled. I smiled. "I won't," I said. "I won't leave anything behind." When I walked in the door, the phone was ringing. I dropped everything, ran for the receiver. It was an out-of-breath Jimmy. "I want to be with you," he says. "I want you. I never said that to anyone before. I'm leaving Donna. She gets back tomorrow. I'm telling her tomorrow. But first I need to check. Do you want to be with me?" And he suddenly struck me as so young and a little desperate. But I said, "Yes, I do. I said, yes, I do. Anyway." I've always felt like somewhat of a mystery to myself, as if there were whole territories inside me that existed beyond the grasp of my comprehension. I love having so much inside remain unknown. That's why I've always distrusted psychoanalysis. To me, at a certain point, it eats away a person's mystery. "That's not mystery, that's pain," say my friends. It seemed like everyone I knew was trying to explain themselves. "What about instinct? Gut feeling," I'd say. "When I die, they'll find intuition at the wheel." It was probably fear still sitting in the back seat trying to bark out directions, but intuition at the wheel. "Be warned, Lillian. The way you got him will be the way you lose him," was the general consensus of most of the over-psychoanalyzed people I knew. "He's a lost and broken boy, and you're not his mother." When I married Jimmy, no one was invited. "Don't you want anyone to give you away?" he asked. To which I replied that I'd be giving myself away this time, thank you very much. We were married in a registrar's office by a man whose accent was so thick that to this day I'm still not completely clear what I was agreeing to. Not wishing to appear rude by asking him to repeat everything two or three times, I basically just said yes, yes, yes.
There was a plastic cherry blossom tree in each corner of the room, with little fake birds on its branches. Upon closer examination, the birds were holding "Love is Blind" signs between their bills. Looking closer still, I noticed the birds had no eyes. Charming, I thought. Jimmy showed up wearing a jacket that can best be described as looking like it had been snatched off the back of a small child who'd been on his way to a birthday party. And he came up with the shadiest-looking witness who I'd never met before, nor have seen since. I have to say, when I first laid eyes on him, I did think to myself, keep your eye on your purse. Nonetheless, it was quite the little adventure. First few months, we lived together in London. Jimmy got a job pruning trees for the council. One afternoon, I finished up work early, thought, oh, I'll take the scenic route home. By chance, I happened to run into him. He was perched on the main bough of a sycamore, lopping branches. Huge sections of tree were falling onto the road. I called out to him. He looked up sharply. Don't do that, he snapped. You surprised me. That poor tree, I said, the shock will kill it. You have to be brutal about cutting, he said. The more you cut away, the better they do. It may seem cruel, but it's for the best. Sometimes you have to nearly kill something before it will grow. And for a good minute, we just stared at each other without saying anything. Later that day, when he came home from work, he lay down and went to sleep. While he was sleeping, I pulled back the covers to look at him. He never wore clothes in bed, always slept the same way, on his side, with his hands covering his face. Well, I noticed something on his heel. I thought, what the hell is that? He had an ant tattooed on his heel, which I'd never noticed before. It was very tiny and very detailed, a quite perfectly proportioned ant. I lay down next to him, fell asleep myself, and had this dream that Jimmy's back was covered with faint lines. Faint lines and tattooed roads, winding through freckles, crisscrossing his backbone, occasionally passing through a hair. In the dream, I asked him what it was. He answered, it's a map of your life. I laughed. Oh, come on. He said, you started here. And he pointed behind himself. You're about here now. And he moved his finger to a place halfway up his back, over his heart. In the dream, I asked him, why does the map end at your shoulder? And just as he was about to answer, I woke up. He had next to nothing in the way of possessions. Everything had belonged to Donna. One of the few things that was actually his was this little tent that he took everywhere, just in case he ever felt the urge to sleep outside, he'd say. One Saturday, we took a bus ride into the country. Sure enough, the little package came along too. No sooner were we off the bus than Jimmy said, let's forget about going home. I want to sleep under the sky. I have to say the idea did appeal. So we bought sandwiches, supplies, walked what must have been miles, till we found a spot that met Jimmy's definition of the word remote, by which time the sky was quite black. He set up the little tent and pulled out a sleeping bag that he'd had all along. By the time we'd eaten, it was late and Jimmy was beat, so he went pretty much straight to sleep. I, on the other hand, just laid there. The ground was uneven, to put it mildly. I think we were parked on top of a mole community. My spine was wondering what the hell was going on, and it was damp, but I didn't care. It was so quiet in the open. You could almost hear your moods change. If you laid still enough, you could feel your instincts wriggling to the surface. Hours go by. I'm still wide awake, thinking, I'm 41 years old. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm laying in a field. And the whole thing seemed so absurd, I just started laughing. You know what? I thought, good things are going to happen. I'm ready for them now. I wasn't before. I am now. Yes, I thought. I'm ready to roll my sleeves up. My sleeves are fairly twitching to be rolled. For the good things.